While you are likely quite aware of Alzheimer's, you may not know how it works, what sets its effects apart from other neurological issues, or even its departure from normal aging processes. In this edition of Health Connections, we set out to separate fact and fiction regarding Alzheimer's. Dr. Carol Myers speaks with Joel Anderson, a University of Tennessee researcher whose work focuses on Alzheimer's and related illnesses and their effect on caregivers. This edition of Health Connections was edited by WUOT News intern Colton Zenny. This podcast is rebroadcast with permission by Dr. Carol Myers and WUOT's Brandon Hollingsworth in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Hello, this is Dr. Carol Myers from the University of Tennessee College of Nursing with Health Connections. Today I'm joined by Dr. Joel Anderson, also from the College of Nursing, and our topic is myths about Alzheimer's disease. It's a rare person or family who's not been touched by Alzheimer's disease. I have a personal story. One of my favorite aunts succumbed to Alzheimer's disease after several years of decline. She was cared for in her home faithfully by her brother. We are a farm family who live in close proximity to one another. My aunt could have been cast as the quintessential Appalachian woman. She never married, but instead lived in the home she and her family moved to when they left Kate's Cove and when she was a child. She lived with her mother and cared for her until she died. Aunt Bonnie was a storyteller and the family historian. She was a writer and a wonderful gardener. Watching her slip away as Alzheimer's disease ate away at her memory and speech was so sad. We are challenged by this portrait of Alzheimer's disease. The number of older Americans is growing rapidly in the U.S., as is the number of people living with Alzheimer's disease. 5.7 million Americans of all ages live with Alzheimer's, and 5.5 of these are age 65 or older. This number is expected to grow to 7.1 million by 2025. The number of Americans with Alzheimer's could actually triple to 13.8 million by 2050. So the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease is soaring and mortality rates are rising. Two-thirds of the people with Alzheimer's disease are women, like my aunt. Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death, the fifth among people age 65 or older. I'm so pleased today to be joined by Dr. Joel Anderson. Dr. Anderson's research program focuses on non-pharmacological interventions for symptom management and caregiver support in dementia care. He's the right person to have here today. Welcome, Dr. Anderson. It's so good to have you here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, let's begin by defining terms. We sometimes tend to use the term Alzheimer's disease and dementia interchangeably. Is there a problem with that?
It's not necessarily a problem, but it can be confusing. So it is a good idea to sort of set the stage with some definitions before we get started. Dementia is an umbrella term. It is a term that is really about a syndrome. And so this can be Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia, but not all dementias are Alzheimer's disease. There are various different diagnoses under the umbrella term of dementia. But as you mentioned, the most common form of dementia is Alzheimer's disease, and the one that most people hear about.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, when we first started talking about this episode, we both centered on the idea about myths and misconceptions about Alzheimer's disease. Let's talk about, is it inevitable that we'll all get dementia? Is it true that once we have dementia, there's nothing we can do about it?
So that's kind of two myths in one. The first myth is that this is a normal part of aging. It's not. We think of Alzheimer's disease as losing our memory and memory loss. And oftentimes, we have instances where we might forget a name, we might forget something that we have scheduled that afternoon. Those are sort of regular lapses in memory. The memory loss that comes along with Alzheimer's disease and dementia is more profound because it affects the way that we actually go through our daily lives. So we have recurring lapses in particularly short-term memory and have difficulty in problem solving and other cognitive functions and tasks. And so that's not a part of normal aging. So the myth that, well, Granny's 85, so, you know, she's got dementia, is not necessarily the case. It's not true that this is a normal part of aging. To your second point about, is there anything that we can do about this? Actually, there is. While the majority of the risk associated with developing Alzheimer's disease and dementia, about 65%, is associated with things that we really can't change over time, like age, other family history, or the level of education that we got maybe when we were younger, there's about 35% of the risk that we can modify. And that has to do with diet, physical activity, controlling chronic conditions like blood pressure and diabetes, and being engaged socially with family and friends. Those can actually reduce our risk. And it's a great percentage of the risk. As I said, it's 35% of the risk of developing this disease.
Okay, so can we talk more specifically? One of the things that we are committed to on Health Connections is, what are the things that we can do something about? What does this mean to the average person? So you talked about things relative to engagement, to nutrition, to activity. What are some of the specific things that I could do to reduce my risk of Alzheimer's disease? And I assume this all is in the area of brain science and some of the things we're learning about how to enhance or at least maintain cognitive function?
Absolutely. And we continue to learn more about the ways in which we can support the health of our brain. So I mentioned nutrition and diet. We know from a lot of research that a plant-focused diet is very beneficial to our health. And one of the ways in which it does that is it reduces our risk of cardiovascular disease, which then in turn reduces our risk of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So diets like the Mediterranean diet, which have a heavy focus on plants, particularly fruits and vegetables, are beneficial if we're wanting to protect our brain health. Physical activity. It doesn't have to be going to the gym every day. Simply taking a walk 3 or 4 times a week can actually increase the size of the part of the brain that's involved in memory, the hippocampus, and help maintain the connections there. And it's as simple as taking 30 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week of just a nice walk.
I'll say, so far the prescription is moving to a Mediterranean-type diet, 30 minutes of exercise 3 times a week. What are the other things that we can do to prevent Alzheimer's disease?
One of the things that we know that is beneficial for preventing Alzheimer's disease and also for slowing cognitive decline in those individuals who have already been diagnosed is social engagement. Spending time with family and friends, and when you're spending time with them, doing something, having a conversation, knitting, working on puzzles, things that not only engage the social side of things, but also keep our mind active, can slow the cognitive decline for those who have Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and can also keep our brain sharp as we get older.
So you talk about social engagement. I have to assume that that's the opposite of social isolation, which we have talked about previously. Okay. One of the things that's interesting to me as you talk about this is that it's not that each thing that we fear, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, that they all have a set of disparate recommendations for prevention or addressing the disorder. They tend to have some common denominators, and to me at least that makes it easier to say if I adopt this healthy lifestyle, it has protective effects that go beyond whatever may be my biggest worry, Alzheimer's disease or cancer or heart disease. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. This isn't new information. What's new is our understanding of how these things work and how they support the health of our brain.
So we've talked about nutrition, physical health, cognitive activity. Let's talk a little bit more about that. You talked about it in relation to social engagement, but can I do things to keep my brain active and healthy that doesn't involve social engagement? Can I do word puzzles or anything else that would help to protect my brain?
Absolutely. Those types of activities, crossword puzzles, Sudoku, those kinds of things, do keep our minds engaged and keep us making new neurons. That was one of the things that we thought that we couldn't do for a very long time, was to create new neurons in our brain as we get older. And we can. There isn't a lot of good evidence, though, to support a lot of the brain training games. And one of the reasons is why these games have you do the same thing sort of over and over again. And so you get very good at doing that task, but that doesn't necessarily translate over into everyday tasks. Mm. So it's a good idea, kind of like with diet, to have a variety of different games and ways in which you keep your mind active.
Great. So we've talked about two myths, that Alzheimer's disease is an inevitable part of aging and that there's nothing you can do to prevent Alzheimer's disease or slow the course of the progressive disease. What about, I have Alzheimer's and my aunt pretty much just said it was inevitable that she was going to decline, she was going to die, and really didn't want to do anything, and I noticed that people withdrew from her. What about in that period where I'm living with Alzheimer's? Does that phrase even make sense, living, not dying with Alzheimer's?
Absolutely. One of the things that I think is important is the fact that this diagnosis does not mean that you can't do things anymore. It does mean that you're going to progress through this disease, and at certain points there may be times that driving is not a good idea and those sorts of things. But the idea that once you have been diagnosed with particularly early stage, mild stage, or mild cognitive impairment, that you can no longer be a productive member of society or help with your family is not true as well. There are lots of people who are living well with Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and they often get involved in patient advocacy in terms of spreading the word that this is not who I am. I am still a person. I am still valuable. I still have something to contribute. And so they often get involved in a lot of research efforts and raising awareness. And the reason, one of the reasons that they do that is to combat the stigma that comes along with this type of diagnosis. People do withdraw because they don't know what to do. They don't know what to say because they make assumptions about who the person with the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and dementia might be.
So it's hard to think about a person with Alzheimer's disease and not think about the people who care for them. In many cases, it's family members or other close people. In some cases, it's nurses and others in institution. So let's talk about what can caregivers do to address the stigma and to change the paradigm of dying with Alzheimer's to living with Alzheimer's.
I think one of the things that we can do is think about the language that we use. As you say, it's living with, not dying from, to sort of remove the word suffering maybe from our vocabulary, particularly when we have a family member or a loved one who is just recently diagnosed and is not having all of the big difficulties that people assume come with Alzheimer's disease immediately. Getting informed through this type of program or other types of research and valuable resources like the Alzheimer's Association or the World Health Organization that put out evidence-based research and information that is useful for caregivers. And then also taking care of yourself. It's difficult sometimes to deal with some of the symptoms that might come along with this diagnosis. And so it's very important that family caregivers also practice self-care. There are nearly 16 million family caregivers in this country, and they're providing billions of hours of unpaid care. And it's important that they take care of themselves.
So we need to care for the person with Alzheimer's disease as well as the caregiver. I think that's a very important point, since, again, this disease touches so many folks. I do want to mention that on Thursday, June 21st, we have the summer solstice, which is the longest day of the year, and the Alzheimer's Association is sponsoring an event called The Longest Day. Clever, huh? Mm-hmm. But on this day, people worldwide will engage in various activities to raise funds and awareness about Alzheimer's disease. Money raised on this day will be used for research to find ways to prevent Alzheimer's disease, something that we are very early in our understanding at this point, screen people to identify the disease early and develop effective therapies. And we're encouraging all of our listeners, as they're able, to join in these activities. Dr. Anderson, is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners that either have the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, are caring for someone, know somebody, something that you want to end the program with.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning the Longest Day campaign. June is National Alzheimer's Awareness Month and Brain Health Awareness Month, so now is a perfect time to find all kinds of information that can support you and your family member with Alzheimer's disease and dementia, as well as the rest of your members of your family. As you mentioned in your story, it's a family affair, and it takes a village to provide care so that the person with the diagnosis can live well. And so I think now is a great time to find the information that you might be looking for.
Thank you. Dr. Anderson, what a treat to have you on Health Connections today. Thank you for sharing your vast knowledge. And more importantly, I could see the caring in everything that you said. Thank you.
Thank you.